put out our funds in hand, it will be objective. We're going to made out, but I know it's going to be. It's going to be covering from the 20th century on, page 19, under Paul Solis. Yes. Again, on page 19. It will cover, it will depend heavily, and most of these exams do upon the syllabus. However, it will also cover material in the handout and material up on the board that's not in the syllabus. You want to have extra three lectures, inspection, and so on. So that's some stuff on the board. Talk about that. So you'll be responsible for that. If you don't have good notes, word of warning. It will be true and false. Identification or definition, briefly defined words, identified stuff, and a major manuscript syllabus. Any questions? Statistics is the one with the moment. One moment. With a listing of one each. That's all there is, one for each. Looks like that. Shouldn't take you, I would guess, over 30 minutes. Maybe with the news and the time that today is not in the hour of the time in the hand. We'll get a couple in on what
we're going
to do. I have one of your first. Actually, I've graded it. I do an hour of the as well. But he kept talking about it a lot of words. Every time I came in, he apologized for the paper. I went back and looked at it, and now it's down to a few. If I were you, I'd quit talking about it. Well, I haven't said it yet. Wrong about this stuff. Usually, before I grade me, I'll tell you it's a bit different. Well, I hope you learned something in this course. There's an important thing I'll think about this stuff in the paper. This paper, I think, is frustrating when you write a paper in this course because you go up and you go off in so many directions and cover so much, it's better because it's broad. And I'll try to keep that in mind for everything.
Close your eyes, man. I'll be yours for the braille method. My braille here is still. Thank you.
Lord, tell me what you want to say. Okay, now, looking at this handout, let us finish the origin of life and spend the rest of the day on this. I listed for you alternatives. You don't know these alternatives to popular textbook abiogenesis. We looked at those. And what this is, this is based on the prologue of this book. I think you'll be familiar with this book. I'll be interested in this subject. I'll be in the library and giving that to you. Although it's not complete, I haven't shown it. It's not completely based on that. So just to look at this based on the prologue. What concerns scientists about creation? Where we are now. That is, why do many scientists tend to flinch at creation? As a knee jerk response. Turn away from creation. Well, number one, and this is a problem that wrote by Olson and Bradley in fact. Creation involves the supernatural, and modern scientism has a bias in this fact. It's like if they argue this way, and I've read this in a number of books, it's on a pattern, and it's a strange, it shows what Romans 1 says, it demonstrates very clearly. The role of the will and unbelief. It's like saying, they'll say, well, this is a book on science. And we're going to talk about origins from the viewpoint of science. We don't take it as science, we take it as well. I'm paraphrasing. This is a pattern of time to go. I can't tell you how many times I've worked through this. Okay, we're going to talk about origins, and we're going to take a scientific approach. Now, it is the realm of science, therefore we could not be able to deal with it. Therefore, we will not deal with it. Therefore, we will not consider only a naturalistic explanation.
trust the judge, and try to get an accurate explanation of the viewpoint of it. It doesn't work. What's the problem with logic in that? Is it true that if there's a supernatural explanation for origins, that it is outside of nomination? That's true. I mean, outside of the realm of science, that's what we're talking about. That's true. Yes, that's true. Okay, that's the first part of this course. Well, then what about the logic of saying, well, since this is a proof on science, then we will not consider this supernatural. But if you gave a sentence, you say we do not consider it. Well, is there anything wrong with that? There's anything wrong with a book, and I'll say again, there's anything wrong with a book saying, an author saying,
I'm going to look at only at the possible, I'm only going to look at the explanation of origins that could possibly be dealt with in terms of science. I'm going to go look at those. That's fine. That's a good one. I'm going to have a very narrow perspective on that. Okay. That's what is illegitimate, and where this whole business becomes scientific, is when the author says or implies that somehow his explanation is the only, or the kind of explanation that he offers is the only possible explanation, and therefore the supernatural is ruled out. You cannot rule out that explanation. That is, in other words, if they read a book on the creation of biology, and going in, the author says, we're not going to consider creation. Then coming out at the end, his conclusion, if his conclusion is not creation, it simply is insignificant. It is not significant that his conclusion is not embraced by the end. And there's where the pride is in the art. Because the breakdown of logical thinking, the textbook will rule out supernatural going in, and then attach some significance to the absence of the supernatural coming out. And it's just a logical fallacy. And if you take a narrow perspective, a narrow perspective can, which is legitimate if you want to write from a narrow perspective, but you have to admit, here's what scientists do not recognize, or not that you've got to see it. I have found that many evolutionists, for example, are not very well educated. They do not have a liberal education. They're very parochial education, very narrow education. They talk about biology and microfamily, but they take one inch to the right or left of biology and they're stupid, you know, right? That's a very subtle thing. And, what's my thought? Where you have a breakdown, where scientism is true, is where this author is writing from this narrow perspective but does not admit or does not recognize that a narrow perspective very often will shield you from the truth. That is the danger of working from a narrow perspective. It will shield you from the truth. I'll give you an example, an analogy, okay? Let's say you got a person who's acting in a sexual pervert and a serial murderer and acts crazy in a bed bug. You kind of figure out what's wrong with the guy. Well, I would say, if the guy acts like that, he hears voices, as a similar sentence, I would say that a possibility is he's even possessed. It doesn't mean he's even possessed, but that's a possibility. Why? Because human possession exists, it often manifests itself in just that way, although often a person will act that way, not being even possessed. So I'm trying to find out what's wrong with the guy. If a person goes to examine the guy, he's a modern Freudian, and he says, I do not recognize the existence of
ugly one. And it may not be the right one. Truth may be that Bellamy deals with that. So his narrow perspective has shielded him from the truth. That is, a narrow perspective can guarantee that you're not going to look at the truth. That's true of anything. A narrow perspective will guarantee that you will not come up with a true conclusion. You might come up with a conclusion. And you might come up with a conclusion, listen to me. But it is one thing to come up with a conclusion and a study, which is the most plausible within the confines of your perspective. But that doesn't mean it's the truest. And that's what you have in evolution test. Especially with abiogenesis, chemical evolution. So an explanation which is the most plausible within the confines of a narrow perspective. It's the most plausible of two or three naturalistic explanations. But the true explanation is not naturalistic at all. I mean, that's the whole point of perspective, because guarantees that you're not going to come up with the truth. In fact, the point is what we're doing.
So, there is, so, but number one, scientists are concerned about creation. They kind of shield away from it because they say, well, it involves the supernatural. And I would say, so what? If the supernatural exists, see, the question, listen to me, a liberal education, in the good sense of that term, in the traditional sense that's been used in Western civilization, liberal education does not ask the question, what is scientific? A liberally educated man asks the question, what is truth? It's a very superstitious kind of mind that says, that equates those two. That the question of what is scientific, quote A, and what is truth are necessarily the same question. That's pure rationalism, empiricism, positivism. But it won't work. And of course, the grand fallacy in that is, if you cannot show scientifically, the supernatural does not exist.
If you think you're going to be bound by science, that's going to be your perspective. It could only hold if you could prove scientifically, that's going to be your only perspective, that the supernatural does not exist. And of course, that cannot be proved methodologically, nor can it be proved logically. Because it's very difficult to show why it does not exist. To show that God does not exist, you have to be everywhere in the universe at the same time. So in one place you were not as particular about exactly where God is. But it's very difficult to show.
You all understand that?
Okay, so it's another perspective.
Secondly, the second concern that scientists have about creation is that creation entails discontinuity. Now, the majority of scientists prefer continuity. What is continuity? That is, that everything we can see, everything in the material world, can be explained in terms of a chain of cause and effect that goes on unbroken into the infinite past. This is the modern mind of scientists. That everything we see, the biological world, the organic world, the non-organic world, everything we see must be explained in terms of an unbroken chain or unbroken chains of cause and effect, traceable back to the infinite past. Not that we can see every link, but every link has been there, and if we had we could go back in time or had sufficiently honed or refined methods, we could identify each link. Well, it doesn't insist on seeing each link, identifying it, but it posits that each link was there. And science prefers continuity. That's one of the reasons they like this. They don't like miracles. Why? Miracles are a discontinuity. Are they not? That is, now, listen to me. Miracles are a discontinuity in terms of naturalistic cause and effect. They are not a discontinuity in cause and effect. Simply reduces the cause and a sufficient cause. Miracles do not, in some things,
rebuke the concept did not defy, or spiritual did not defy cause and effect. It is a sufficient cause from the outside, and let feel as it were. When Jesus fed the 5,000 with a little boy's lunch, he did not defy cause and effect. He simply did it with a sufficient cause.
Well, the time don't like that. Notice, yeah, I capitalized the word prefer. Now that shows a bias. Why? What is significant about the word prefer? Yes, why not?
Right.
Now, supposed to prefer. The scientist who conducted pure science isn't supposed to prefer anything. He's supposed to discover. Good science does not prefer. Once you start preferring, then everything is warped. That's like, for instance, you see this, a lot of people. In my estimation, several hundred thousand people are going to die for the simple reason that modern research on AIDS is being biased by tremendous social pressure that prefers a particular construct of AIDS that is. There's a tremendous social preference that AIDS not be a homosexual disease. Therefore, there's tremendous pressure being brought upon the field of medicine to not treat it as a homosexual disease. And I am convinced that is going to slow down and hinder, in some way, the medical solutions that there is one to the disease, as a result of people dying. For instance, if AIDS were treated without preference, what you would immediately do would quarantine the homosexual community and test them and let them break out of that quarantine only if it was shown they didn't have AIDS. That's what would be done to report any other disease, for cholera, diphtheria,
but shown that it's not like part. Don't you have a situation here with homosexuals that because part of homosexual that will not come out and admit to that, it was good to do it that way.
Well, but it might help. But you would at least isolate all known ones. For instance, that were typhoid fever. If you can see a typhoid fever was 75 to 85% of people who had it within a certain social group, that group would immediately be quarantined.
Obviously, having AIDS and being a homosexual does, right?
Well, yes, statistically, 85% of all the people that have typhoid fever live in Texas County, Texas, or residents of Texas County, Texas. They would be able to quarantine in Texas County, Texas, so they got the thing under control. That's the procedure. That procedure is not being followed. Why? Because there's a tremendous preference that is not being treated. So the fact. And then that person, that pretty good understanding that approach is going to cost hundreds of thousands of people their lives. Because
eventually
they don't have been arrested, but then contained if it's not being contained. Will not be contained. They contain to give blood, they contain to associate freely, they contain to do all kinds of things. And so people are going to die. And frankly, and I'm not very good. I'm having a hard time working as a chair of sympathy for anybody that hemophilia actually lives in other countries. In other words, homosexuals to get another homosexual and heterosexuals to get a prostitute. They're going to have a tough time getting sympathy out of me. They're going to get down, but they're going to have a tough time. I'm going to work it out. You know, because I was raised not to appreciate it, and if I had to become a minister. But anyway,
you see the danger of preference? For instance, if you, in trying to the scientific method of diagnosing a disease that causes the yellow fever or something like that, you don't go into it and say, well, we prefer this be the explanation because it would help us. No, they'll science will not do that. You can't believe. What they do is they try to rule out preference by pseudo methodology, which is good science. But except in this case, they prefer continuity. Why? Well, good question. Why? Well, you see, immediately if you introduce discontinuity, that is a naturalistic discontinuity, which represents a break in a naturalistic scheme, then immediately it takes it outside the realm of science. That is, science can not analyze the turning of the water into wine. There's no why, because it doesn't mean it's not true, doesn't mean it violates cause and effect, simply takes it outside the realm of perspective. Third, well, I've already talked about the quantum revolution advancing over the continuity. We've talked about that today. Creation might destroy the scientific quest for knowledge. The third reason why science sort of shies away from creation. Now, what do we say about this? You see, here's what they often say. Well, if we start introducing the creator, then the quest for knowledge is going to die because everybody's just going to back off and say, well, God did it. Why? Kind of like the ACLU, utter hypocrisy, who will defend the rights of criminals to the extreme, saying, well, we're really defending our own rights. By that I'm saying, for instance, a church group wants to close down a pornography shop. ACLU will argue, look, if you do this, then the next thing that's going to happen is they're going to take your Bible away from you. Which is silly, of course. Well, in that same mentality, scientists will often say, well, if you introduce the possibility of a creator, the God who creates and the God who intervenes through miracles, immediately everybody's going to say, well, they're going to stop looking for the cause of diseases. They're going to say, well, God is punishing them. And they're going to have no grand unifying theory, and everything's going to break down because men are just going to dismiss the quest for knowledge, attributing everything automatically to God, which is the natural. Now, the first thing I would point out about this is the creationist roots of modern science. It was not the atheistic worldview. Like I said before, what the atheists were doing, were writing crazy utopian schemes, and men like Robert Owen. The atheists in the 17th and 18th centuries were a bunch of cuckoo birds. They were not doing anything constructive. Most of them have been probated before lunch if they were around today, as far as their social schemes. It was the theists, the most vivid work from a vivid or at least a theistic worldview. It was the creationists who created modern science. You didn't know that. Creationists did that. Their quest for identifying the order which they believe God built into the creation. So that's just historically ridiculous.
Couldn't some scientists go get this for instance, Dr. Calvin, who was good at everything, absolutely.
Yes. Or some branch of fundamentalism. But that's really not an excuse because there's such a massive body of literature on creation science. It's just so clear. That is, the scientists said, well, we can't allow creation because it ends the quest for knowledge. That is simply hysterical nonsense in the light of history. In the light of all the literature that's available, simply hysterical nonsense. I would point out some of the leading pioneers in science and space and technology in medicine are believers. You do not find a correlation between believers and demons. That is, in those fields. We don't find believing scientists. holding back and dragging their heels on unbelievers toward the head. Matter of fact, it's the unbelievers that are getting the superstition. The superstition comes in. Okay, and here's a very important point. The failure of many scientists to distinguish between operation science and origin science. Now, this is a very important point. Let's think this through together. The failure of modern scientists and many scientists to distinguish between operation science and origin science. For instance, they say, well, if you posit a creator, then that will end the quest for knowledge on origin science. On the origin. Now, what is the difference, first of all, between creation in origin science and operation science? In other words, operation and origin. What is operation science?
When it's either data-driven research or advanced technology, how things work.
That is, and by the way, many modern textbooks, because of the furor over evolution in creation, because of that controversy, are sort of ignoring origin science and sticking with operation science, and because of Ned Weaver in California took care of that, put more origin science on it. But you see, operation science is simply the examination, the observation, and in some cases, the reproduction, the reduplication of what? Of how, of what is going on, how it works. Now, origin science is a different thing, different kind of thing. You see, what this book points out, I mean, yes, and what creation has been playing out for a long time, that is a fundamental mistake to try to explain origin in terms of operation. That is, the uniformitarianism holds and scientism holds that the principles observable in operation science are sufficient to explain origins, even if they are not. It's like saying this, that if you take the instructions on how to operate a computer, or how to take instructions on the operation of the computer, extrapolate those instructions, which you've got to build on. I promise you it won't go to huge specific things. And I may not be good now, but I can take a moment. And what many scientists, you see, they, and when it comes to creationism, here's the fallacy, the flaw in the thinking. They say, well, we cannot allow discontinuity in operation science, or we can have nothing to say about it. That is, we believe that some bacteria causes disease, and we identify that the bacteria or the virus, or we have a virus, and we can deal with the disease, that kind of thing. And we don't stop and say, well, God causes everything immediately. Otherwise, we don't have time. That's true. And of course, a Christian recognizes this. And God, we call this the law of nature. God establishes a continuity. But that business doesn't apply in fundamental religion. And many scientists apply this. Here's what I'm saying. Scientists and many scientists apply the same categories when they're talking about operation science. Or is that one way to word this correctly? They apply the same categories when they're talking about origin when they do operation science. They simply will not work. It's a lot of and you talk about both of them, they're the same thing. They're not the same thing. Because origins, by their very nature, are not operations. By their very nature.
one thing to talk about how they self-operate. That does not say where it came from. Well, that's a very important point, is it not? Now, so creationism deals with origins, not operations. You got that? And so, listen to me, no strict creationists would never, it would be a logical fallacy for a creationist to lose interest in operation science. And the head creationists have been pioneers in operation science. You all see that? That is, creationist has genesis. If you're going to say, creationism deals with origins of science, obviously. And creation, in other words, if you look at it simply logically, a creationist has just as much interest in operation science as a non-creationist. There is nothing in creationism that logically reduces interest in operation science. The quest for knowledge goes on. And the quest for details about origins even goes on. Y'all see that? There's nothing built into the idea of creation that in any way reduces interest in operation science. And scientists assume that's true, and it's simply because it's false. The fact that they are misunderstand that reflected the fact that they would say, well, creationism will destroy the modern science and stuff and all. Because all I'm saying is, it is historically false to say that, and not really true the other way around, and it is an error to say that because it has to be in operation. Okay, any questions on that? Well, now we come to metaphysics and the origin of life. We have seen the demise of positivism. Quantum physics destroyed positivism. The idea that you can trace in simple mechanical fashion everything to its roots and to its conclusion. Not true. Why? Because, as we've already talked about, quantum physics introduces the concept of uncertainty into it. Positivism is dead. Then we come to the myth of presuppositionless science. Because of relativity and quantum physics, and even before that, there is no such thing as presuppositionless science. That is, I don't mind the evolutionist telling me that I approach the subject with presupposition. I just don't want him telling me that he doesn't. You got that? I don't mind him telling me that I operate from a philosophy. He can tell me that all he wants to as a creationist. He's a Christian. Because it's true. I just don't want him acting as if he doesn't operate from a presupposition, from a philosophy. Because it's impossible not to operate from that philosophy. You start with a presupposition. Otherwise, you could draw no hypothesis. You see, here's how this works. You see, here is the hypothetical deductive method. You know how this works. Hypothetical deductive method says it starts with here's your evidence, your line of evidence. And it starts with a hypothesis. And the hypothesis reflects a philosophy, that is, for instance, what we think, a hypothesis is, I think that X is true. But you see, if I think that X is true, therefore I think X is possible. I would not think it would be true if it's not possible. And what I think is possible is determined by my philosophy. Did you get that? What's possible? For instance, now, that is what is possible.
not what is plausible, but what is possible. Then I say, well, if X is true, then it predicts A, B, a hypothesis or a theory. It predicts. You see, the validity of a theory depends upon its power to predict. Therefore, I say, this is a scientific answer, I say that if X is true, then A, B, C, D, D, that is my validity evidence, I should find A, B, C, D, D. If a certain virus causes this disease, then I can find this, the blood should show this chemistry, and it should respond to this treatment, and so forth. And it should not respond to these other things. The ability to hear to predict. So that's the evidence. And here I work inductively from the evidence, and I find, lo and behold, A, the magic. I look at the evidence, it might be paleontology, it might be experimental evidence, anything I can observe, okay? And I find B, okay, just fine. Then all of a sudden, I don't find C, I find Y. Uh-oh, the break. And I don't find D, I find R. And then I don't find E, if I'm examining, I find F. Well, what happened was, it didn't work. So then what do I do? Well, then I move on to another hypothesis and a theory. And I make some predictions. I'll predict F, G, and H. And then I look at the evidence and see what I get. And I'll go on until it becomes law, becomes quote true or a fact, when what the theory predicts is what the evidence demonstrates. Now, can you understand that? And then if this doesn't work, then I move on to another one. Another hypothesis. That's my prediction. If this is true, I should find this, but if the evidence is probably fine. Okay? Now there's evidence, there could be all kinds of evidence. Paleontology, mathematical, could be with probability, could be with anything. This is not now. This is called the hypothetical inductive method. That is, the hypothetical deductive method is you draw a hypothesis, you deduce from the hypothesis what you should find, then you work inductively to see if you find it.
Hypothetical deductive.
Science uses a hypothetical code. Hypothetical deductive for hypothetical deductive. Any questions on that? You understand that? Now, here we're talking about presupposition of science. You see, your presuppositions come operate here because your hypothesis will only manifest what you think is possible. If you do not think it's possible, you will not manifest as a hypothesis. Now, the problem is where philosophy and bias and presuppositions come to bear is right here. That is your willingness to move on to another hypothesis when your hypothesis has failed to predict. And in the area that we're talking about, in creation versus evolution, the evolutionist does not
many of them scientism is written. Not evolution, they can use more correct. Scientism, by its very nature, does not admit it. If this hypothesis is the supernatural, the supernatural creationism, you see, suppose you're a man, a scientist, whose philosophy says that this is possible, but this is not possible. That's your philosophy, your bias, your presupposition. Then, what you're going to do is you're not going to cross over this line. And at that point, you stop being a new scientist. And what you do is, you labor with C, D, and E, or ignorance, or how you do with it, play games with it, and try to say, well, really, it does, the evidence does fit the prediction. This is where, for instance, this is where Murray Eaton says, fellas, the evidence does not produce what these theories predict. And gradualism, you see. Neo-Darwinism predicted gradualism. What is the fossil evidence? Discontinuity, not gradualism. See what I'm saying? And the genetic, what we know about genetics says, not gradualism, discontinuity. So, what many are doing, like the authors of this book, they're moving over. They're saying, it did not predict the evidence, therefore, we're moving over. And my position is that the creation hypothesis predicts certain things, and while there are some problems with every view, what the creation hypothesis predicts is what you find. For instance, the creation hypothesis predicts discontinuity in the fossil record. What do you find? Discontinuity in the fossil record. The creation hypothesis predicts that there will be new information not possible through naturalistic genetics. What do you find in biological order? New information not made possible by operation science. That is, there's nothing in the way that information is passed on that explains how you can have new information. Genetic information, DNA information. You understand that? So all I say is that the creationist hypothesis does a better job of predicting what you will find when you work inductively with the evidence. But here's the problem. Here's the thing. If you will not cross over, there's no such thing as presupposition. This has a presupposition. This has a presupposition. You might think of both are possible, which is, you see, if you think that this is possible and this is impossible, then your bias, your presupposition, is going to keep you from the truth. Is that if, as a matter of fact, this is true? Now, you see, if you think that both is possible, then you simply go on what is the most plausible. And if there are problems in the connection between evidence, then sometimes you can't get at the evidence, or you don't know how to interpret the evidence, then you go with plausibility. And I think that the creation hypothesis, the creation model, as you say, the creation model is the most plausible. As do thousands and thousands of world best scientists. But you see, the thing that keeps scientism away from the truth, as we would say the truth, is their unwillingness to cross this line. What keeps them from crossing this line? Going on to the hypothesis is their presupposition. Does that help you? How to think about this? Now, listen to me, I realize a lot of details you already know about. I'm going to pick up your helmet. I'm going to teach you how to think about this. See, if you have sometimes you can take something that's simply impossible. But you can try to do it in Birmingham, that route. You know, if you had come to me, I'd have left my house, or left my life, but that's not my bill, if you made a mistake. It was my presupposition, it was my philosophy. And so I didn't even bother with that. Now I'm just kidding. I jumped on a shelf or something. Send me your own bill or something like that. Well, a couple of days ago, I sent me back a photocopy of my receipt. There it was, my credit card number and my signature. $14 and a ticket.
Well, that was impossible, and I fused Gene for 45 minutes, and then I decided to, I knew it was a waste of time, perfect waste of time. But I checked my receipt, and lo and behold, that's what I found. On the receipt, my signature, of course, my signature on that page, and where I had it filed, it was there was the name was right there. Showed that I bought a tank of gas at a Shell station in Fort Payne, Alabama. Then I was really confused. Now listen, and then it took me 20 minutes to cross that line. I sat there and I fussed and I got my book out. I hate to show my new back where I was. It was during spring break. I was in Bristol. I had a revival in Bristol, Florida. I knew how to spend the day. And I had not been talking to Birmingham. And it was a credit card, and nobody had a credit card but myself. My wife did not end up there with a credit card. It didn't make a difference for a second. I thought, well, my wife, both of them might feel like this, make a trip. I also walked along my credit card and took a credit card and then I remembered that my wife didn't have any either. Not anybody else in there. And this shows the mentality. It took me 20 or 30 minutes of looking at that receipt when my copy to accept the fact that I had signed that receipt. The bill was mine. That meant there had to be another explanation. Then, as you notice, I thought that the only thing was trying to figure out how I could have been in Bristol, Florida, and Fort Payne, Alabama, in the same morning. And I think, what I'm saying is, it took me over an hour and a half to admit the possibility that there was my signature. I thought, okay. Why? Because my presupposition was it could not have been mine. It was the hardest thing in the world to let go of that. When I finally, I figured it out, by the way. I figured it out, but I didn't figure it out. I didn't come to the truth. I figured it out. What is it? I didn't even come close to the truth until I finally said to myself, well, I'm going to figure this out. I've got to admit that that is my signature. So the receipt is my bill. I do sign it. Therefore, since I signed that, there has to be an explanation. Then, operating from the presupposition that it was my signature, for a long time, operating because it could not have been mine, because I could not have been there, and I didn't know anything about this. Therefore, tell me, since I could not have been there, it could not be my bill. So, if I could not do it, I'm looking that I, even though I had that in my hand, my copy, that I stayed home with my bill forward and put it on file, it still was a long time before I could admit it was mine. So I put my mind in order that if I'm going to come to it, I'm going to have to admit the obvious truth. This is the objective fact. That was that I did by, that is my credit card. That would be it. Inductively, I observed that the clerk was going to question my signature, the clerk's file was the right name. Okay. Once I crossed over the line, then it became a clerk's assessment. I thought that I had that morning. And that morning, I had both hands together. And the railroad, I had no question. But my memory was working. And I went to a shelf station in one time, I was saying, Mary Perry. And the shelf station did open that morning. And I remember that the guy said, he came back to me, only after I had admitted that it was mine, changed my presupposition. He came back to the guy and said something about they were going to have to use the coming year credit card machine because they had got one made up there as they had to do the total. And that's what I was going to use the credit card machine. Unfortunately, I'm not. Very similar. What I'm saying is that after I crossed the line, I admitted to the object. I fought for an hour and a half. I fought the object that I looked at the receipt and trusted and accepted it. I said, it cannot be mine, it cannot be true, blah, blah, blah. Once I crossed the line, I figured out that I knew. Now, you see, and this is what the evolutionist did. I thought you'd ask him to tell you this. Look at the end of it. And the end of it is very clear. And he stares at it, and he twists and turns it, and denies his why. So he can't quite make himself very often off the line. They knew not how. But it might be true. In other words, this is I. That's the natural human mind, because I took me so long. It was really it's a commentary on your own prejudice, on your presupposition. Why should it take me over an hour to admit that was my purpose? And I had the irrational and it was left there in the because of my presupposition. Presupposition really couldn't have been mine because I've never been aboard an hour now. That's how the human mind works. How do you understand it? That's a very difficult illustration of this. Well, this is the future of the intellectual and mechanical
problem. Okay, so then the codes. When I'm not even on this platform, we looked at the demise of college positivism and the myth of presupposition of science. The mind of scientists, I say, is often unable to recognize its own biases and presuppositions. They think they are nothing but objectivity and purity, inductive purity, and that creations have nothing but prejudices and biases. Did you understand the principle I was trying to teach you on this? Very basic. Look at metaphysical commitment versus reason. That is, the commitment to metaphysical naturalism has been defined from contradictory evidence. Creation is often manifest as similar mentality. You know, we admit that creation is often demonstrate that mentality. But here, this statement that the commitment to metaphysical naturalism and defines the contradictory evidence. Where on my diagram here would that fit in? Oh, where is it illustrated?
In the letter.
Right here. Mm-hmm. Right here. Where what is found does not meet what is predicted. And but the commitment to rather than crossover, you simply deny it or play games with it, I'm giving the nonsense. That's where they say, at this point, they say all kinds of dumb things like, well, given enough time, anything can happen. Because my hypothesis didn't predict, but that doesn't make a difference, it's true anyway. Any questions on that? Special creation, and look at special creation in the other thing. Creationism offers the more reasonable explanation of the phenomenon. That is, here, creationism predicts better. And here, and I give you some examples here. An oxidizing early earth, that is, early earth contain oxygen and the point here is that chemical evolution would be impossible in an oxidizing earth. That is, oxygen, you know what rust is? That's oxidization, and it oxidizes. There's oxygen, unless there is a machine, a biological machine to counter it, oxygen oxidizes, it breaks down. Because that is, all this Miller-Urey stuff, test tubes and the amino acids, that oxygen breaks down all those compounds. You understand? You're right, you got that in the reading vision. Now, oxygen, you should know that. But oxygen breaks down, any kind of order of complexity that could have been produced. And so, an oxidizing early earth, a short time between Earth's cooling and the appearance of life. And this is according to the author here. I'm not sure we would agree with all this, but the point is that that even if you grant the evolutionist
his time, he doesn't have enough time. The time gap between the cooling of the earth, where life would have been possible, and the appearance of life is too short, even for his own mathematics. That's the point here. Understand, he doesn't have all the time between, he doesn't have enough time. Third, the absence of prebiotic soup, with all these organic compounds floating around just waiting to get together and form a committee and call it a cell, that simply does not exist. There's no evidence whatsoever for a prebiotic soup. Then the problem of, we've already talked about, of information, and then the problem of complexity. You might have put in your notes versus order. Complexity. The scientists fail to distinguish between order and complexity.
That is, they'll boil the amino acids together, and because of what's called, because certain chemicals are naturally hydrophobic and others are hydrophilic. That is, some oppose, some react to water, some are attracted to water. Hydrophobic compounds are like, if they react, it turns away from water, they line up away from water and hydrophilic toward it. So if you get certain, you'll get certain orders, certain chemical compounds, but that is not the same thing as complexity. Often scientists confuse the speech of order as if it were complexity, and order is not complexity.
So the word here is complexity, is the right word. These are, that is, on these things, you got this, A, B, C, D, and E, we would list them right here. That is, and the creation model fits better. For instance, creation explains how you could have life in an oxidizing atmosphere. Creationism explains why you do not need a lot of time. Creationism does not need the prebiotic soup, therefore the absence is no problem. Creationism provides the information. Creationism predicts information from the outside. And creationism, the creation model, predicts complexity. And the evolutionary model of chemical evolution answers none of those. It breaks down every point. Okay. Any questions on that? This is sort of bringing things to a close here. Well, we look at plausibility. Here's my word over here. Plausibility and creation. The principle of falsification does not apply to origin science. That is, that's what Popper, that Karl Popper says in the Kuhn-Popper debate. Popper says that evolution can never be anything but a philosophy of biology because it is not subject to falsification. That is, at least prebiotic evolution is not subject to falsification. It cannot show that it could not have happened. Therefore, you cannot prove that it did happen scientifically. It's going to be a philosophy, a biology. But note this, neither is creation. But listen to me, creationism is not falsifiable either. Is creation a scientific hypothesis? The answer is no, it is plausible, but it's not scientific. In the sense that, in the strict sense, you can make scientific arguments for it, but it is not in the type of analysis a scientific hypothesis. Because it is constricted, because it is not falsifiable. Because neither is total organic evolution. Why? Because you cannot go back and reproduce a process active only in the past. And by definition, with origin leads to a process active only in the past. The origin of the universe only happened once, no matter how it happened. You cannot go back and see it. All you can show is what's like, what is plausible, the plausible explanation of what probably happened. And the creation model is the more plausible. And by the way, Popper admits that. The plausibility of origin science is based on causality and uniformity. That is, what caused what we see, and what explains the uniformity of the natural order.
you see what I'm talking about here? The plausibility of operation science does not depend only on causality and uniformity. Why? What is the plausibility of operation science? What would you add to that? Not only causality and uniformity.
Operation science can build on more, such as experience, demonstrability, reproducibility, you can, you know, observation. The origin science, you cannot observe it, you cannot reproduce it. All you can do is posit the most plausible cause, the most plausible explanation for uniformity. In operation science, you can measure, observe, demonstrate, reproduce. So it is origin science that's based only on the causality and uniformity by definition. Because you can't reproduce it and observe it, that we can falsify. Conclusion. The above discussion, this is the author's conclusion, is not meant as a scientific proof of a creator, but is merely a line of reasoning to show a special creation by a creator beyond the cosmos, number five up here, the special topic. It is merely a line of reasoning to show that special creation by a creator beyond the cosmos is a plausible view of origin science. That is simply saying we could cross this line. The line, there's nothing in science that says that we cannot cross that line.
Is this a quote from
the book?
Yes. Okay. Any questions? Well, I'm finished.
Turn your paper in for the book with you. I have the end of the seat, then you have my helmet.